Anthony Sumich, a priest of the Priestly Fraternity of St. Peter, bringing you this show from the Catholic Diocese of Auckland, New Zealand. Let's begin today's show with a prayer. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Ghost, amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. So, with our show here, our weekly show, we have been going through a long history of the Catholic Church. But if you do want to get some information about the remainder or the other part of our apostolate, our daily masses, our confessions, our sacramental preparation, the classes that we have, you can find this information on our website, which is fssp.nz. So that's fssp.nz, or have a look at our Facebook page, FSSP Auckland. And you're welcome to come along to some of our Latin masses that we have here in Te Aratu in Auckland, or to some of our classes, the catechism class in the evenings on Tuesday evenings, or the apologetics class on Monday evenings. And we have a large number of active groups working in the parish. But you can find all this information on the website and on the Facebook page. So for the rest of today, we are going to go back to our history, which we haven't been doing for about a month now. We've been preparing for Easter, of course, and had some of our Easter prayers and the like, which we were doing in the last few weeks of the show. Anyway, so if you remember the last time that we were talking in the show, we had the massive uprising of Martin Luther in Germany, but also the situation with the Holy Roman Emperor, and also the situation with the current Pope, where things were starting to really deteriorate as the Pope's lead in the church at this time was entirely focused in the situation in Italy and not really paying enough attention to what was happening in Germany at this point in time, and this was only making things even worse. And of course, there is the side event, and it's not a very small side as well, whereby 100,000 Turks with 300 cannon were marching across Eastern Europe like a massive avalanche. And they came down into Hungary and crossed the Danube River, or they were up by the Danube River around the town of Mohács. Now, Hungary in this situation had fallen far since the days of the heroic John Hunyadi and the centuries when it had been the shield of Catholic Europe against all its enemies to the east. Now, while in Western Europe during the past 50 years, kings everywhere had consolidated their power over the great nobles, in Eastern Europe the trend had been in the other direction, with the great nobles becoming stronger and more independent. Royal absolutism has grave dangers, but no monarch in Europe was yet absolute or close to it, and an invasion by 100,000 well-organized and well-led Muslim troops could not be stopped by private military enterprise. A national, indeed an international effort was needed under a highly competent commander. Now, Hungary had no competent commander and made no national effort. Its king, Louis II, was an irresponsible and dissolute young man of 20 who did little more than play at being king, and therefore he was absolutely no help at all. When Cardinal Campeggio went to Hungary in December of 1524 to alert its king and nobles to their peril and to prod them at least to raise an army, he found no response except from one warlike bishop, Tomoro of Kaloska. When Bishop Tomoro marched off to the southern frontier in February of 1525, he had only the 300 troops that Cardinal Campeggio had raised for him at his own personal expense. At a meeting in July, John Zápolya, a leading Hungarian nobleman who aspired to the throne, threw out the whole royal council with only a token protest from King Louis but did nothing to strengthen the nation's defences. So, on April the 23rd, in the year 1526, Sultan Suleiman marched from Istanbul with his mighty army. Hearing the report of their departure, Baron Burgio, the papal representative in Hungary, wrote to the Pope that once the Turks arrived in Hungary, quote, "Your Holiness may look on this country as lost," unquote. Late in May, Louis II belatedly appealed to Emperor Charles V for help, but by the time the letter reached Charles in June, his new war with France and the Pope was impending, and he believed he had to retain all his military resources for that. By July, the Turks had reached the Hungarian frontier, where a tiny garrison, consisting mostly of troops raised by papal representatives and funds, held out heroically for 2 weeks in the citadel of Peterwaden against the immense host of the Turks. But when, in mid-August, Sultan Suleiman reached the Drave River, the Drave River, the principal military obstacle on the road to Budapest, he was astonished to find that the river was undefended. He built a bridge of boats across it in 5 days and had all his army across the river in a week. On August 29 was fought the decisive Battle of Mohács. Upon encountering the Turks, the main Hungarian army, under the personal command of King Louis II, charged the enemy at once against odds of more than 2-1, not even waiting for John Zápolya's army of 15,000 to come up to reinforce them, though they were only a day's march away. Fighting Bishop Tomoro was killed along with most of the Hungarian army. 2,000 Hungarian heads were piled in front of the Sultan's tent, and at least 1,500 prisoners were slaughtered. King Louis II fled the field, but his exhausted horse stumbled crossing a stream and threw the king into the surging waters, where he drowned in his armor. On September the 10th, the Turks took and sacked and burned Buda, the capital of Hungary, and then fanned out to ravage the countryside, mostly flat or rolling open land with no natural defences. The conquest of the greater part of Hungary was not consolidated by the Turks for 3 years, and its only immediate result was an unseemly scramble for the tottering Hungarian throne by Archduke Ferdinand, brother of Emperor Charles, Dukes Wilhelm and Louis of Bavaria, and John Zápolya, the leading Hungarian nobleman, who had failed to get to the Battle of Mohács in time. Ferdinand was the strongest of the claimants and was elected first king of Bohemia, a second crown which Louis II of Hungary had held, in October, and then king of Hungary in December. This double royalty, along with the ancestral Habsburg estates in Austria, which Charles had given his brother, laid the foundation for the later Austro-Hungarian Empire. But at this critical moment, neither he nor any of the other claimants to the throne of Hungary did anything to defend, regain, or revive the country. The Turks were left free to incorporate most of Hungary into their own Ottoman Empire, leaving them established only 50 miles from the heart of Europe at Vienna. 80 kilometres for those who are challenged with the old system of measuring. On September the 20th, the Colonna invaded Rome, as if things weren't going bad enough in Europe. Italy had to have its own wars. Left almost defenceless by the Pope because of his military commitments elsewhere under the new alliance, many in Rome welcomed the Colonna, and few Romans, angered by the Pope Clement's walls and their cost, showed themselves disposed to defend him. The Colonna and their adherents attacked and looted St. Peter's, while the Pope fled by the covered way, running from St. Peter's to the huge, impregnable round fortress of Castel Sant'Angelo, which had once been Roman Emperor Hadrian's tomb. They even took the papal tiara, but that evening, Spanish ambassador Moncada returned it to the Pope, simultaneously showing that the emperor had good relations with the invaders but that he had no intention of trying to depose the Pope. Moncada negotiated a temporary settlement, a 4 months truce in the war in Italy, the Pope to bring back his troops to Rome, and a full amnesty for the Colonna, who kept 30,000 ducats worth of loot from the Vatican. Charles' participation in this affair through his ambassador is very hard, even for his admirers, to justify. Since the Pope was making war on him, he was entitled to defend himself, but hardly to connive at the sack of St. Peter's and its despoilers keeping their loot. Yet still, he stopped short of claiming any power not his by right, such as to depose the Pope or call a council on his own authority, though he did suggest the College of Cardinals to do so, or giving the slightest support or encouragement to the Lutherans. Pope Clement VII was now advised by several of his cardinals to leave Rome, where he had been shown so vulnerable and so lacking in popular support, but he resolved to stay. In November, Giovanni of the Black Bands, the patriotic mercenary, brought his men to Rome to enable the Pope to regain full control of it. Emperor Charles V's army in Italy now consisted of nearly 50,000 men under the overall command of the traitor and adventurer Charles de Bourbon, who was constantly and desperately short of money to pay so large a force. There were also more than 6,000 imperial cavalry commanded by Philibert, Prince of Orange. The rest of the imperial army was infantry in four different and sharply divided national components. The largest of these was the 18,000 Germans commanded by George Frundsberg, Prince of Mindelheim, a ferocious old warrior who was a convinced Lutheran, as were most of his men, and carried with him a silken rope that he was planning to use to hang the Pope. Bourbon made no religious distinctions among his men. Anyone who would come and fight for him was accepted. There is no indication that Charles, still in Spain, knew the religion of the German troops fighting in his name. The rest of the infantry consisted of 10,000 Spaniards, commanded by the Marquis de Vasto, 6,000 Italians, commanded by Fernando Gonzaga, and 8,000 Swiss. If these men, regardless of nationality, were for long unpaid, they would cease to fight and turn on their commanders. Among the commanders, only Frundsberg aroused strong personal loyalty in his men. Now, the four-month truce agreed upon after the Colonna raid on Rome was due to expire in January of 1527, and Charles's Italian viceroy, Lannoy, demanded, as the price for its renewal for 6 months, a large payment by the Pope and the temporary surrender of four cities in the Papal States and two in the domain of Florence, home of the Pope's family, the Medici, as surety for it. On January 25, a new envoy from Charles, Cesar Fieramosca, arrived in Rome with his personal confirmation of this demand. 3 days later, Pope Clement VII accepted it and signed the treaty, including the extension of the armistice for 6 months. By the very next day, January 29, after being told that aid was on the way from the French and the English, by the way, it was not, the Pope spectacularly broke his word and violated the armistice by sending his troops to attack imperial positions. Now, one may search in all of papal history in vain for a more imprudent or irresponsible act by any pope. By mid-February, Charles de Bourbon had scraped together enough money to send his army from mutiny, keep his army from mutiny, and had taken many of his troops from Milan to join with Frundsberg in the Lombard plain. Attrition, desertion, and leaving a strong garrison in Milan had reduced their total number to about 22,000. On March the 8th, they camped less than a day's journey from Bologna in the Papal State. With none of the reported French and English aid forthcoming, Pope Clement VII made yet another switch and signed another truce agreement with Imperial Ambassador Fieramosca. Each side was to give up its recent conquests. The colonna would be absolved and restored, and the Pope would pay 60,000 ducats to Bourbon's army, which would then withdraw from the Papal State. Viceroy Lannoy would come to Rome in person to ratify the treaty. The next day, the cold, wet, underfed and mostly unpaid army of Charles the Bourbon, which had been dreaming of plundering the rich cities of the Papal State and even Rome itself, hearing reports of the truce negotiations, though not yet of their outcome, rose in mutiny. Only Frundsberg had enough prestige to try to retain control of his men. When his exhortations failed to convince them, he collapsed with a stroke. On March 20th, Fiera Mosca arrived at the camp with 30,000 ducats, half the required papal payment for the truce. But this came to less than 2 ducats a man, not nearly enough to bring the mutiny to an end. Fiera Mosca had to flee for his life. On March the 29th, the Pope and Viceroy Lannoy ratified the armistice treaty, but on the same day, Bourbon sent a message to Lannoy that he no longer controlled the army and so could not carry out its terms. He reported that the men were ready to advance southward on their own accord. The next day, the advance began. The composition of the army had changed substantially from what it had been earlier. Nearly two-thirds of the 22,000 were Germans. Almost all of them were Lutherans. The remainder were Spaniards and Italians. The Swiss had gone home. Suddenly, this was a Lutheran and not an imperial army, dominated by followers of the man who had called upon his people to wash their hands in the blood of the clergy, eager to make Rome their objective. It could no longer be justly called Charles V's army, for neither he nor his officers commanded it. In those days of slow communication, when it took at least 2 weeks for a message to reach central Spain from Italy, Charles was then at Valladolid on the high plains of Castile, and therefore a full month for a message and its reply. Charles could not have learned about the mutinous army in time to do anything about it, even if he had a loyal army in Italy large enough to stop it, which he did not. While Charles must bear part of the responsibility for the Colonna raid of September 1526, he bears no responsibility whatsoever for the sack of Rome. Early in April, though warned that Bourbon's army had mutinied and was advancing south, Pope Clement VII disbanded his entire army because the truce had been signed. No wonder some contemporary observers thought he had gone mad. He was not, in fact, insane, but had evidently suffered almost a complete breakdown of his power of judgment. On April the 3rd, Viceroy Lannoy left Rome with 80,000 ducats to try and buy off the advancing army. Probably realizing this was not enough money, he went first to Florence, another possible objective for the army, and persuaded its rich men and leaders to provide 150,000 ducats for the ransom of their city. The mutinous army was crossing the Apennines to march on Florence when Lannoy reached them with this offer, which Bourbon, now speaking with the voice of his men, demanded be matched for Rome. As Lannoy undoubtedly knew, the papal treasury was exhausted. Unable to make such a payment, he could find nothing to say in response to Bourbon, who on April the 26th made the final decision, with the enthusiastic agreement of the Germans to turn away from Florence and march on Rome. Critics of Charles Emperor V, who claim he wanted the attack on Rome, which he did not and could not have known about before it happened, to take place, say that Lannoy's failure to make a vigorous verbal protest against Bourbon's decision proves their point. Surely the experience with Bourbon and his army had established by this time that words with them were useless. Only money talked, and Lannoy could not promise money he and the Pope did not have. On May the 2nd, the mutinous army arrived at Viterbo, just 60 k's north of Rome, and Pope Clement VII seems then suddenly to have realised for the first time the magnitude of the peril. French Ambassador Dubellay saw him that morning and described him as in a state of inexpressible terror. Yet he would not flee, though many urged him to do so, and many others did. Rome had strong walls and a reasonable number of soldiers, though many were little more than poorly trained militia to defend it, under the command of an apparently competent officer, Renzo Decidi, in whom the Pope had blind confidence. But Renzo was either a fool or a traitor when on May the 4th, Guido Rangone, with 8,000 infantry and 500 cavalry, arrived at Viterbo the day after Bourbon's army left it. Renzo sent him a message that his army was not needed. Rome was adequately defended. And on the evening of the 4th, Bourbon's herald appeared at the walls of Rome demanding 300,000 ducats immediately for the ransom of the city. The Pope's excommunication of him was not a response that had much relevance at that apocalyptic moment. That night, the mutinous army camped in the vineyards behind St. Peter's. The ragged, starving men had no place to go but forward. They had no supplies, no support, no place to retreat, no opposing general to surrender to, even if they could have had quarter. No one had money enough to pay them. They must storm Rome or die. On May the 5th, they resolved to attempt it the following day. All that night, the great bell on the Capitoline Hill rang the tocsin. Dawn came with a thick fog hiding the attackers from sight. They had no usable artillery, only hand weapons and ladders hastily constructed out of the garden palings and bound together with withes. Their first and second attacks failed. Bourbon led the second attack in person and fell mortally wounded from a ladder. At 6 o'clock in the morning, the Spanish attackers made a breach in the wall near the Vatican with a pickaxe, so narrow that only one man could pass through it at a time, while the German attackers found a cellar connecting a house outside the wall with one inside. Instead of rushing to block these two very narrow entrance points, Renzo Decidi panicked and fled, crying that all was lost. In the Vatican, there was no warning of the breakthrough before it happened. Pope Clement VII was praying in his private chapel when the distracted Renzo burst in, screaming that he must flee instantly. He had only minutes, perhaps only seconds, to get away. Swords were already swinging and blood running at the high altar of St. Peter's that stands directly over the bones of the fishermen, where most of the Swiss Guard, in the noblest moment of their long service, were giving their lives to save the unworthy Pope from the cursing, bellowing horde of armed savages surging into the mother church of Christendom. Still, in his glistening white cassock and red skullcap, the Pope ran for his life, accompanied only by the historian Paolo Giovio, who later described the whole fantastic scene. The covered way from the Vatican towards Castel Sant'Angelo emerges upon an open wooden bridge giving access to the impregnable fortress. It was now full morning and the fog was gone. The Pope in his white cassock, high up on the bridge, could be seen from a considerable distance, and the attacking army was full of men who had sworn to kill him. Giovio flung his own purple cloak over the Pope to hide his white cassock, took off his skullcap, and hustled him through the gauntlet. Descending from it into the fortress, he saw a desperate, milling mass of humanity at the main gate, all trying to push through. One of them, who succeeded, was Cardinal Pucci, who had been thrown from his horse and trampled. One who did not succeed was Cardinal Armellini. He was trying to get inside when the castellan, knowing St. Angelo was full of fugitives, there were 3,000 of them, with no room for more, let the portcullis down with a tremendous crash, its huge iron spikes impaling anyone caught beneath them. His torn red robe saved the cardinal's life. Identifying him by it among the mob, the guards on the walls let down a basket for him. He climbed into it and was hauled up. On the battlements, the famous sculptor Benvenuto Cellini manned the cannon, seeing that their iron balls swept the streets around the fortress to keep the attackers at a distance. It was the only refuge. The nightmare horrors that followed echo down the ages like screams from hell. The sack went on for more than a week. no one was spared, regardless of age, sex, wealth, or nationality. Those unable to pay ransom were tortured and killed. And when ransoms were paid, more was demanded. Thousands of women of all ages were raped and many tortured. Priests were murdered and mutilated, nuns dragged through the streets. Every church was plundered by the Spaniards as well as the Germans. The Blessed Sacrament was desecrated. The Germans proclaimed Luther Pope in a mock ceremony. Much of the city was burned. Tombs were opened and ransacked. The great golden cross of Constantine that had been in St. Peter's for 1,200 years disappeared and was never seen again. The head of St. Andrew was thrown into the street and the veil of Veronica taken and offered for sale. The Vatican Library and the Raphael rooms adjoining it were saved only because the Prince Philibert of Orange, the nominal commander of the invading army after the death of Bourbon, made his headquarters there. A Spanish observer wrote a few weeks later, "In Rome, the chief city of Christendom, no bells ring, no churches are open, no masses are said. Sundays and feast days have ceased. The rich shops of the merchants have turned into stables. The most splendid palaces are stripped bare. Many houses are burnt to the ground. In others, the doors and windows are broken and carried away. The streets are changed into dunghills. The stench of dead bodies is terrible. Men and beasts have a common grave. And in the churches I have seen corpses that dogs have gnawed. In the public places, tables are set close together at which piles of ducats are gambled for. The air rings with blasphemies fit to make good men, if such there are, wish that they were deaf. I know nothing wherewith I can compare it except to the destruction of Jerusalem." So that was the scene in Rome after this incredible sack by this force, which originally had begun as an empirical force to fight against the papal armies, but in the end became a rebellious, mutinous force that took on a life of its own. Far away in Spain, Emperor Charles received the news of the sack of Rome and Valladolid with grief and sorrow, and at once suspended the public celebrations of the birth of his son and heir, the future Philip II. The Archbishop of Toledo and the Duke of Alva urged him to release the Pope from captivity in Castel San Angelo at the earliest possible moment, and the bishops of Spain considered going to the Emperor as a body clad in mourning to beg him to set the Pope free. By extraordinary chance, Charles' Imperial Chancellor Gattinara was already in Italy. He had gone for a long-delayed vacation to his native Savoy. Hearing of the march on Rome, he had gone quickly there, and on May the 7th, the day after the successful assault on Rome, he made his way to besieged Castel Sant'Angelo. There the shattered Pope, in tears, told him he flung himself on the Emperor's magnanimity. Gattinara set himself to try to work out a new agreement between the Emperor and the Pope. So it proved a long and difficult process to disentangle the position of the Pope as head of the Church, desperately in need of help, from his position as the defeated and captured head of a sovereign state which had been at war with the Emperor and his allies. On June the 5th, the Pope formally surrendered to the Emperor and agreed to pay 400,000 ducats, the imperial treasury, but continued to be held at Castel Sant'Angelo until the first 100,000 ducat payment was made. Nothing could be done to reclaim most of the mutinous army, now scattered all over central Italy, still killing and looting, but dying rapidly of plague generated, appropriately enough, by the decomposing bodies of their victims in Rome. But if Charles were to keep order in Italy and defend his possessions there, he must have an army, and it still seemed to him that the Pope, whose hostile alliance had made that army more necessary, should pay part of its cost from his state. So that's the situation in Rome in this horrendous time, with the and also in terrible things happening, of course, in Hungary, and the church looking in a terrible state. But unfortunately for today, we have actually run out of time, so we'll have to close the show right here and now. We hope to have you back with us next week as we continue.